I don't like talking about experiences like this a whole lot on the air, but I was given the grace this morning of tripping out into like having LSD without taking anything. And I saw that it's infinite. It's truly infinite, and it truly is moving so fast, and it's so beautiful physically that, I mean, the colors and everything, whatever it is. I decided it was sort of an octopus. But and how do we decide at what point in that octopus is continually moving, writhing, exquisitely turning? What do you call an octopus's things?
Tentacles.
Tentacles. Yeah, each of those tentacles is. And there's an infinite number of tentacles, and each tentacle has an infinite number of realities. And how do we learn to hone in on one that's easier for us and everything else in the universe? And are we that important? I think we are.
Well,
wait a minute. I haven't finished.
Okay.
I'm almost done. I think that we can do that by learning how to focus our attention on what we want, not on what we don't want. That's really very simple.
Personally, I'm not always able to clearly identify the true intent of some of my own actions. You know, especially when a situation I find myself in causes me to react without first thinking. So how do you pay attention to your own true intent?
Oh, boy.
You know, so you say that energy follows consciousness. You know.
How do you become conscious?
Yeah, and how do you remember that at every moment?
You don't.
Yeah.
I think we're just humans, and we're learning how to do it slowly. Sometimes I can be in a very poor state for action, like a state of fear or anxiety or something like that, for a long time before I even know I'm doing that. And then all of a sudden I say, wow, whatever it is I've said or done in the last 10 minutes, don't trust it. Let's start all over again with this one. No, it takes, yeah, I think that's what Buddhist teachings are and everything. Actually, what I kind of decided was, I think we're all afraid of getting high. I mean, it's not just the folks who, those poor people who put all those poor people in jail. It's all of us, somehow or other. And that we need to be aware of that as a very significant factor in our holding on to 3D land.
Where do you think that fear comes from?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, in time space, it seems as though it might be a direct result of evolutionary trends that took us through years and years of shortages. There's that. But I think it's almost, I don't have the, I really don't know. It's like we're in a natural state of high is natural. That's what. A lot of things are leaves and maybe ants, for all I know. I don't know how they do, but it seems as though somehow or other the human race didn't eat the apple when it should have, or something like that. I don't know. That's just figurative, of
sure.
course. It's just amazing to me that we carry this burden, but it certainly has been interesting sorting out what it is, which is what spirituality's at its best has been about since ever.
Yeah.
And maybe not everybody is like that. Maybe there's some isolated tribes, places where people are brought up in such a loving environment, accepting environment, that they don't have that fear. But I'm kind of dubious.
Okay. Earlier this year, just after a relationship I was in ended, you shared some of your personal insights about love with me. At one point in your life, you realized that instead of trying to fall in love again, you should try to become a loving person. It's That's what you told me?
That's right.
So how is being a loving person different than falling in love?
Aha. Well, yeah, I think you can combine the two, but I couldn't. See, I got into disaster because I didn't know what the difference was. And there's a falling in love that is an ego play. Not that ego is bad, mind you, but an ego play said where the ego is saying there's something wrong with me. If somebody loves me, if I'm in love, then I'm okay. And that's what I was doing, I think. And I was falling in love with these people, very inappropriate for me, and getting into all kinds of trouble. So I noticed all of a sudden one day, instead of the men all turning around on the street and looking at me, they stopped. I mean, it was like that. All of a sudden, one day, all of a sudden it stopped. And I said, gee, something new's happened. Not that I liked it. And I spent a long time alone, and I did a lot of ritual by myself. And I really prayed to learn what love was. And that's when I met Patty. It's been an interesting learning, hasn't it, Patrick?
Yes.
But I think it's possible that the two could be combined and you could fall in love and learn to love. It's a big commitment, though, because the falling in love part where you see somebody else is this exciting, extremely desirable and all kinds of different ways human being fades. And what's left is learning to love those attributes that may be the exact ones that rub you the wrong way. That takes practice.
Yeah.
And patience.
So do you have any insights you can offer parents and educators today about bridging the generation gap and cultural differences between them and kids? I mean, that's an age-old question.
See, to me, I said in the Haight-Ashbury days, I was saying, don't break your guitars. Mm-hmm. Don't break their guitars. You know, parents were breaking the guitars of their sons because they had long hair. God. Anyway, Well, I think it has to start from the beginning, and I see great hope because a lot of the people I know who are parenting and homeschooling are doing it with a whole, don't you experience that, Patty? Real differences in how things are as far as parent-children relationships are concerned or not?
Well, I do. I think a lot of parents are more conscious and loving in an unconditional way that they accept their children as the children are rather than as the parents want them to be.
I have to say this KKUP Cupertino People's Radio peopling here. I don't have an answer to that. I'm just glad that I do feel a change from the terrible rigidity of when my children were babies. It seems to me from the beginning, home birthing is a sign of it. Birthing underwater is fabulous. Anything that builds honesty on every level instead of a blind acceptance to the mores, sexual and otherwise. And at the same time, if you're going to send your kids to school, they have to know what's accepted. You can't just go to school and say words you can't even say on the radio here. I can't tell you that you can't say fuck it. But I just did.
So, Patty, I think you hit it on the head, which was parents who, you know, the difference between parents who want their kids to be something and those who accept them for what they are. I think when parents don't accept their kids for who they really are because they don't fit into their plan for them, that's when, you know, the cultural differences really rift.
Sure, I think young kids are open. And they become imprinted with scripts from their parents. Don't be you, or don't be, or be like me. And so, you know, a lot of us grew up with that kind of robot. We've been imprinted like a CD and that's what we put out. And I think our function is to become aware of the cultural, the economic, the spiritual, and the other imprints that we have received, and begin to get rid of them so that we can be more fully who we are. And who we are, I think, is spiritual and joyful and unconditional loving and accepting and all oneness.
That's nice.
So this is a question that either or both of you can answer. What is the most significant event that has happened in your lifetime?
Oh, I'd like to answer that.
Yeah.
The most significant event in my lifetime was my second LSD trip. And there's no doubt about it. And I'm eternally grateful that the universe provided me with that. And it changed everything for me. How about you, Patty?
Well, I think I'd have to say is the influence of Ken Kies and the Living Love Center in Berkeley, where we worked on ourselves every day for the whole summer and took responsibility for who we are, what we said, our feelings, our words, our actions, and not putting the blame on other people. And growing in love and acceptance of others.
That's great. So it was 32 years ago today that the California bill criminalizing the use of LSD was passed.
Wow.
32
really?
Years ago today. 30,
and there was a big celebration in the panhandle.
Were you there?
I was still wearing high heels.
Were you?
I took LSD about a week after that.
So since then, the laws and subsequent punishment for possession of drugs have become stiffer and more harsher. And in many cases, the sentences received by people violating drug laws is more than twice the duration of sentences received by people who have committed violent crimes, such as assault and manslaughter. Mm-hmm. So in your opinion, what are the drug laws today? Why are the drug laws today so draconian? And what can people who are concerned about this do?
Well, I think we all need to work politically. Angela, Dave, I've said it a few times in the last few weeks, but one out of every 133 Americans is in jail. I didn't bring with me, alas, all the printed material I was going to read, actually, about what we could do. It's very important for all of us to take an active, at least to some extent, role politically, and to see what we can make happen as far as voting in people who won't be that afraid. This is fear, of course. It's terrible fear. And on the one hand, fear, and on the other hand, we're caught in the snares of the capitalist system, and it has some good things, but it has some terrible things about it.
In our culture, talking openly about death seems to be a taboo subject.
Oh, boy.
I believe this is due to our culture's disconnection with the spiritual life and the resulting deep-rooted fear from that emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
So do you fear your own death, and are you in any way preparing for it?
Oh, yeah. I am preparing for it. I mean, it's obvious when you can't breathe that something different's happening. And as the can't breathing increases all the time, so I can't escape from the fact that I'm dying. And everybody else can, even though they are also dying. Yes, we've had a terror. I don't know where that fits into the whole Calvinist thing. I shouldn't use Calvin particularly, but the whole thing that I was talking about, maybe it was because a lot of the earlier Christian religions said that only 144,000 people were going to be saved and everybody else was going to boil in oil or something. I'm not quite sure what they say, but it's pretty grim and dreadful kind of thing. And when you think about heaven and hell, and you think you might be going to hell, that must have been dreadfully difficult for people. Yeah, there's a part of me that's scared to die, and I love telling the story about Suzuki Roshi's last words. Suzuki Roshi, who started the Zen Center in San Francisco, whom I admire very, very, very greatly. The Zen master's last words are considered some kind of particularly sacred, and his last words were, "I don't want to die." And I really admired him for that. Wow, what honesty. Is that amazing? Thank you, Patty. Just amazing. So there's that. And then when I have an experience like I had this morning, I couldn't hardly wait to die. And then I remember what that LSD trip was, and that it appears though there's some kind of consciousness, and I'm really fascinated by what the world consciousness is right now. I don't know the answer. I don't know that anyone knows. You got any hints, Patty?
On
what consciousness is.
That's a perennial question. We're always talking about it.
Yeah.
Around and around and around. And I think it's growing awareness and expansion of how we see things and people and the world and the cosmos and God, Goddess.
I don't know what it is. But there's some kind of consciousness that exists outside of the limitations of Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And I know that it goes on forever, because there's no time, in fact, in that world.
Yeah, I like the notion of consciousness with the intent of organizing itself in a way to strive to understand itself.
Oh, yeah, that's what our function is. We're informing God, as it were. And that's every cell of our body. I buy all of these adventures and learning. And that's why I think that's what time is about. We sort of invented it in order to, I don't know why, actually. But it seems as though we sort of invented it to have all these adventures and be able to sort out, well, it doesn't work to kill all the Serbs. So let's stop doing that way. And it doesn't work to put everybody in jail. So let's stop doing it that way and slowly learning. And that consciousness, whatever it is, doesn't have, it isn't this beautiful as it is. Well, I was being very grateful this morning that we got slowed down. And the leaves said they're grateful that we got slowed down, because they'd never could exist otherwise. Neither could we, I guess. I didn't answer the question about death in any depth, perhaps. I don't really feel there's such a thing. That which we are can't die. We were never even born. This is all a figment of our imagination.
Yeah, it's just change, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
but the process now, I really would like to die easy. I almost died the other morning if Patty hadn't been there. I was choking on mucus here. Choking, I couldn't breathe. And he came in and pounded me on the back. I don't want to die that way. I want to die in a state of grace, not struggling. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm asking for that.
Yeah.
Might as well ask for it.
Absolutely. So are you familiar with the cultural climate in the Haight-Ashbury today?
No.
I live in the Haight-Ashbury. You know that. From my perspective, the despair and violence among the street people occupying the neighborhood is overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And there are large numbers of homeless and drug addicted youth and very little resources available to them, even if they do choose to get help with their problems. In vast contrast to this, the merchant community in the neighborhood continues to gear itself towards providing goods and services for the more wealthier and prosperous consumers in the city. It's kind of a growing rift. And of course, this is my perspective. And you have a perspective of what the Haight-Ashbury was in the 60s. What do you think of these changes? And
I don't think it's that different.
You don't think it's that different?
No, I think there was enormous poverty and and great lack of compassion. I was one of the merchants. There was a desire to, I think, to make money on, out of it all. And at the same time, there was poverty that wasn't addressed and homelessness that wasn't addressed. So I'm not sure it's that different. I just feel that we need to change. We really need to change. And the whole issues of poverty and maldistribution of the enormous wealth of this world. What, Patty, you call it a cornucopia, huh?
Yeah.
Talk a little about the cornucopia. People are going to say, oh, we have such shortages. There's not enough food. There's not, and there's too many people, and all of this.
Well, I noticed the Haight-Ashbury when we were up Chips last year, and there was that sense of desperation and despair among the young people that I think is greater than when the Haight-Ashbury was at its peak in the 60s. There was idealism, there was music, there was maybe more tribal consciousness then.
That's true.
And sure, later on there became very serious drug problems and poverty. And I think the poverty that we see among the young people there and elsewhere is only a reflection of our society as a whole, that capitalism produces multi-billionaires and also kicks out people who are marginalized, and young people particularly who don't want to be part of the capitalistic system are finding it very difficult to survive. So that's one of the tough nuts of dealing with the homeless and the poor and the marginalized. And I hope there would be a greater sense of understanding them and compassion and reaching out to them so that those who want help will find it available to them.